Blog Talk Radio.
From their studio in the Feeding Arizona building in Youngtown, Arizona, it's the Boomer and the Babe Show with Pete Peters and Deborah Brown. Join Pete and Deborah and their guests as they give voice to 78 million baby boomers from coast to coast and border to border. Now here are the Boomer and the Babe, Pete Peters and Deborah Brown.
Yes, indeed. It is the Boomer and the Babe Show on Blog Talk Radio. It is Friday, December 9th. 2011, and we're broadcasting as the suspiciously familiar sounding announcer voice says from the Feeding Arizona complex in Youngtown, Arizona, also home of Valley View Community Food Bank. I just can't get off my announcements that Valley View Community Food Bank certainly could use your donations, be it cash or be it groceries. For the Christmas season, they gave out just short of 5,000 Thanksgiving dinners to people in need that were lined up around down the block and around the corner. They gave that away in the period of about 3 days leading up to Thanksgiving. Every bit of food that Valley View Community Food Bank gives out is free. They do not charge for the food. So anything that you can do to help their cause and assist them in their mission will be greatly appreciated. I say that as a board member. So help us out. We can certainly use it. This is the Boomer and the Babe Show, as I said, brought to you by Boomer and the Babe Incorporated. Boomer and the Babe Incorporated is a multifaceted multimedia marketing company where we do more than just this radio show. We also do videos for your websites and the internet. In addition to that, we do ebooks and mini books. Many of our ebook authors that we publish and we put up on the various services also have radio shows on the Boomer and the Babe Network here on Blog Talk. So be sure and take a look at the archives, see what's up there, see some of the shows you might have an interest in, including our own. They're all listed there. They're all available for your listening pleasure. And that's blogtalkradio.com. That's blogtalkradio.com/boomerandbabe, and you can see everything that is up there as far as the radio shows are concerned. Well, this morning we have a gentleman here as a guest that is, I don't know, although I haven't known him personally, I've known of their work and his company's work. I had occasion 5 years ago, my family had occasion 5 years ago to use hospice for the final days of my father. It was a very, very good, very compassionate, and very well-regarded situation with regard to his passing, and they made it peaceful and made it very, 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 very nice, as a matter of fact, that somebody could go with that much peace. And I'm glad to have this representative here from Hospice of America, also Hospice of Arizona, which is part of the Hospice of America chain. His name is Cameron Svensson. He is the Director of Education for Hospice of America. Welcome to the Boomer the Babe Show, Cameron.
Thank you, Pete. Thanks a lot.
Well, we're certainly glad to be here and to have you here. And why don't we start by you just kind of introducing yourself and telling people from whence you have come and where you have come, and how did you get to be involved in hospice, and a little bit of your background.
Sure, thanks. It's been a while. I was a social worker starting in about 1997, and I had an internship here in the Valley of the Sun for about a year where I was a bereavement counselor for a hospice, and that was my first introduction to it. And once I graduated with the social work degree, I elected to go to a hospital actually very close to your studios here, Boswell Hospital, and became a social worker there for 10 years and transitioned about 4 years ago into Hospice of Arizona in the marketing kind of social work component of that. Recently have now become the Director of Education and Advocacy for American Hospice. So it's been quite a trek from the education standpoint to this professional endeavor. it has been, it's been a journey, but, you know, I'm in a place now where I feel like I can make a difference truly for people actually across the United States, making sure that they understand what hospice is and really not what it used to be, not what it was 20 to 30 years ago, but what we're forging in the hospice industry today is so much greater and better and more comprehensive than ever before.
Let's talk a little bit about the hospice industry, and then we'll specifically talk about your hospice during the course of our show today, and we'll also talk about any number of things that people may misconceive hospice to be and some of the misnomers and myths and so on. But as far as the industry is concerned, what is the history of the industry? Can you tell us how long hospice, as hospice, whether it's yours or anybody else's, how long has that been in existence?
You know, I'm not sure if I can give you exact specifics. What we talk about in our presentations out to the community is it's approximately 40 years old. It started really in Europe and then came this way to America, started on the East Coast in Connecticut. Hospice was opened very early in Tucson, but it was primarily volunteer-driven. And there wasn't much more than cancer patients, people who had cancer, and that was essentially what it was geared toward, is providing comfort for the people with that disease in particular. And so it's a young, very young industry, only 40 years old approximately, and it's gained momentum over the course of the last couple of decades since its inception into Medicare's program. Medicare started covering hospice in 1986, and then somewhere between 1983 and 1986, as well as Medicaid covering hospice as well. So, you know, the coverage of it has only been now 24 years old. Very, very young industry, and still growing on a consistent basis.
Now, there are some hospices that are for profit. There are others that are nonprofit, and there are some that may be for-profit, but they have the capacity of being a nonprofit for people that can't afford or don't have insurance to pay. How does that work? Particularly, let's speak of your organization. How does it work with your organization?
What we do is kind of indicate that we're a private company, Hospice of Arizona, a private organization. And what I tell people is that there are two not-for-profit foundations that we are working with. One of them, the Sun Health Foundation here in the West Valley, the other, the Hospice of Arizona Foundation. So I think one of the largest misnomers is that a not-for-profit hospice is something that it used to be, again, back 40 years ago when hospice was started, was a non-profit type service. So nonprofit relies completely on donation. A not-for-profit hospice does not rely on donations. They can solicit donations. They're allowed to do that, being a not-for-profit institution or agency. But they get the same reimbursement from Medicare and other insurance companies as a for-profit company. So what you want to look at when it comes to for-profit and not-for-profit is, how long has that company been in existence? What do they do with their donations? Do they cover people that don't have insurance or that maybe don't have 100% covered insurance like Medicare? And, you know, is that company reputable? So by no means is there any difference between a for-profit and not-for-profit company in how they direct their service. None at all.
The direction of the service certainly, and the services provided, has certainly changed over the years, hasn't it?
It has.
It used to be, correct me if I'm wrong, and I may well be, it used to be that if somebody was in the care of hospice, they went to a facility. They were in that facility, were given as much comfort care as they could, knowing that they were terminal and would pass relatively soon. Is that still the way it is, or is it one of those myths that you're trying to fight?
It is. It is actually a large misconception. When I'm out presenting these programs that I've developed and that we've developed at Hospice of Arizona, we've definitely geared it to make sure that people understand hospice is not a place. It's not a destination. And in fact, 90% of the people that have hospice get that service at home. So nurses and social workers, nurses assistants, therapists, social workers, they all come to the patient's home, wherever they live. If that residence is a private one, whether it's a care center, assisted living, a group home, wherever they actually reside, that's where they get their service. Now, the good news is, because it's not round the clock, there isn't a person who comes in 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. If a person's symptoms are exacerbated, if their diagnosis is such that they need more care or more intervention at that moment, we can have a person transported to an inpatient unit, and that's what we call them, an inpatient unit or general inpatient status at a Medicare-contracted facility. So that's a really valuable asset to having hospice. If a person's being cared for at home by their caregiver, a spouse, a loved one, that caregiver often needs a break, needs to have that break. So using our inpatient units for that reason is a great thing. So whether it's general inpatient status for exacerbation of symptoms associated with a life-limiting illness, or whether it's for what we call respite care, giving a caregiver a break, we utilize Medicare's coverage to have that person go to an inpatient unit. But that's temporary. It's not permanent. So I get a lot of people afraid to call hospice, afraid to accept the services, because they think that if they do, they're going to a place to live and ultimately to die. We want to make sure every time we're talking to a patient and family that we dispel that myth and that we get a person to understand that what is going to occur is services are coming right to the home, free of charge, in other words, covered by their insurance, and they really get the security as well as the visitation of these people, and ultimately to feel better and, believe it or not, many times live longer with hospice.
It's possible for a person to go on hospice care and through a passage of time improve and come off of hospice care.
Sure is.
And that's something that people don't understand, is that they still have this premonition of doom. I'm going to hospice now because the end is nigh and I'm going to pass, which may not be the case. It may be the case, but it may be an extended period of time. And you may live a very productive life for months, years, possibly, in hospice care. Is that possible?
It is actually possible. And I'm actually glad you brought that up now, because, you know, the moment I start talking about hospice in a social situation, I get one of two answers. I get a person that kind of rolls their eyes and looks at me like, oh, how can you possibly work with people that are dying? Or I get the inevitable joke of, wow, it must, you know, people must be dying to get into that. And, you know, I just want to say to anybody I come across, whether it's in a professional or a social setting, is that we are all dying, all of us.
We're dying from the minute we're born.
The minute we're born. And so to not talk about it openly with friends and family, we're already doing a disservice to our friends and family. Not being, you know, to be reluctant to bring that up in conversation is sad. So to be able to say to somebody, well, hospice isn't what you think. In fact, nowadays, in 2011, 2012, and hopefully for decades to come, we will be open with conversation about death and dying, so much so that hospice will become accepted as part, an obvious part, of the process of living. You know, we all go to preschool and kindergarten and, you know, grade school and high school, college and young adulthood, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Having hospice as a next step in life, a passage, a rite of passage, is going to be accepted. But this is just a matter of time.
And a person may need hospice at 12 years old.
That's possible. I mean,
a hospice is not necessarily just solely for the aged and cancer-stricken, as you said initially. It occurs to me that in the passage of time, and as my dad moved towards his death, he was in a a skilled nursing facility because he had issues that he had to that had to be dealt with. I mean, he had IVs in him, and he had some other things and some wound care things that from an infection and so on. Does hospice have a limit as to the type of care they give? Not that what they do is not phenomenal, but I mean, are there certain areas of care, for instance, wound care, skilled nursing, things like that? Is that part of a hospice program, or can it be, or is it something that's done elsewhere?
It definitely can be. We have a fabulous partnership, and when I say we, I mean the hospice industry around the country. We have a great partnership with most, if not all, skilled nursing facilities. Our job is to partner with any long-term care entity to make sure that our services are compatible with theirs and that we work together so that if somebody like your father lives in a care center, a skilled nursing facility, we can send hospice personnel to assist, to complement what they do over at that skilled nursing facility. Now, people still have to meet criteria for hospice. It's not like, you know, if somebody has a mild Alzheimer's that they're going to be appropriate, because what Medicare and insurance companies are looking at for reimbursement is end-stage disease processes. So if somebody with a respiratory illness or a renal failure, liver failure, Alzheimer's, cancer, cardiac failure, or CHF, all of these diagnoses and more in their latter stages are eligible. That person is eligible to have hospices coming into where they live. So again, like your father in a skilled nursing facility, if he had a diagnosis that would support that, you want to get hospice involved immediately. You don't want to wait for a doctor to come around to the belief that, well, now it's time for hospice. Because what hospice in the industry today is trying to accomplish first and foremost is education to physicians out there that will make a doctor understand that it's part of the regimen. Hospice is not the last step. It's part of the regimen of what should be provided to a patient. And if provided at the right time to increase quality of life and provide comfort, that will contribute to somebody's longevity of their life. And I think what a doctor many times is thinking is, wow, if I get hospice involved now, I've given up on the patient. And if we can get physicians across the country to understand that it really is part of their medical regimen to keep a patient out of the hospital and in hospice, and that that physician can continue to follow a patient, then we've succeeded at giving the patient the best opportunity to live a good and healthy end of life.
So a couple of things that came of that little dissertation you just made there. One is that the doctor, the treating physician, can still continue to treat that patient while that patient is in hospice care.
True.
So it's not a case of I'm giving up my patient, sending him off to hospice, and they take care of him and see him out the door, so to speak, to the great beyond, or whatever the case might be. So he still has and can have a hands-on treatment policy for that patient.
That is true. That physician, if they want to, and many physicians don't feel that they're qualified to be palliative experts, palliative care being comfort care at end of life, they many times will say, well, this isn't my role. I should turn this over to the hospice medical director. They tend to be the end-of-life expert. I'll just do that. Well, it's unfortunate because many physicians have developed relationships with their patients over the course of years. What we try to do, again, when we're educating doctors, is say, not only can you continue to follow that patient if you choose, but you can also be reimbursed by Medicare through care plan oversight. So the physician can still get paid to be the so-called hospice medical director for that particular patient if they want to. Now, I won't get too much into detail about that. But again, that's part of our education to make sure that doctors don't sever their relationship with patients just because they think they're giving up on them. And it's far from the truth. They are not giving up on their patients.
Now, I can relate to that from the firsthand experience we had with my father's situation. He was taken to to Boswell Hospital, and was treated there, had an infection, many complications as to why he had the infection, but nonetheless, he had the infection. He was treated, and at that point, his recovery was limited only by the fact that he, well, one part of it was the fact that he wasn't cooperating. Why he wasn't cooperating is another issue, and that's an issue that was an issue between us and the hospital as to why that was going on. So the bottom line is they recommended that he go to skilled nursing because he had an open wound that was not healing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so he had to have skilled nursing care and wound care daily, around the clock almost. They would change dressing 3 times a day and the whole deal. And he wouldn't cooperate with it. But nonetheless, that's so he was given off to a skilled nursing facility. His physician of record, when he went to the skilled nursing facility, for whatever reason, did not follow up with him. Don't know why. Water under the bridge, over the dam, wherever the damn water goes. But nonetheless, didn't follow up with him. He did things like pulled out IVs and was, you know, on and on and on and on. And he was on blood thinners and he had bleeding issues because he pulled off his bandages from skin that had opened up. And it was just a mess. But anyhow, he went from skilled nursing back to the hospital to skilled nursing back to the hospital, skilled nursing back to the hospital. And every time, one step forward, 2 steps back, one step forward, 2 steps back. Eventually, now this is where it comes in, the doctor at the hospital said to us, I think it's time to consider hospice. Your father's not reacting. I knew that he wasn't reacting to various things. He knew we were there. He could react to stimulus. He could communicate to a limited degree. But the physician said, I think it's time to think about hospice because medically we have done everything we can do for him. I look back at it now, and especially after having this talk with you, and saying maybe after that second trip to the hospital he should have gone to hospice. Possibly after that first trip back to the hospital he should have gone back to hospice, or gone to hospice and not back to skilled nursing.
Yeah.
Because at this point, he has Alzheimer's. At this point, we know what the eventual outcome is. And he was not happy. I mean, he was physically battling when these people would come around him. And then plus the fact that I had to retrain the staff every time they had a shift come on. I had to be there for shift change.
Right.
Because any number of reasons, as you know, the HIPAA laws and all that. But I put a sign up over his bed. This is how you treat him, A, B, C, D. Ask for help. Speak into the right ear, so on and so forth. Ask for help. He's more likely to help you rather than tell him what to do. That's his nature. I had to retrain that every damn time. Do not use adhesive tape. Use only Coban. One thing after another, and believe me, I get a sense after having him in hospice for the last 9 days of his life that he'd have been much better there. He had a 90-day, once he left the house, it was 90 days and he was gone. The last 9 days in hospice. But if he'd have been the last 30 days in hospice, he'd have been a lot better person to deal with, and I think he would have been a much happier soul as the time went on.
Pete, your story is so common. I mean, you just not just here at Boswell Hospital.
Right.
Around the country.
Sure. It's a universal story.
It is. Of course it is.
Yeah.
Because we as Americans, I think, knowing that we have the opportunity to go to a medical center or a hospital to fight, we're going to choose that a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And the longer the perception of hospice is that, well, we've given up, the more this type of thing is going to occur.
Right.
If we can accept hospice for the comfort that it provides, knowing that the end is probably coming at some point and that hospitals or doctors aren't going to fix, they're not going to cure what ultimately is going to happen, I think 100% of us would choose to be comfortable for that last month or 6 months or a year than uncomfortable. Going in and recycling through an emergency room or a hospital unnecessarily.
Three times.
Yeah, right. And sometimes it's six and eight times. And if a physician would really be honest with a family and say, I'm going to suggest palliative care at this point, and hospice is a great way to look at this. I know that the first reaction from a lot of people who have some familiarity with hospice is going to be, what? What? Not hospice. But if the physician then takes it a further to say, well, hospice isn't what you think, and here's why I believe that it's the best alternative, most of the time you're going to get a receptive reaction from a family and from a patient. And that's all we can ask, is that we get rid of this perception that exists, and we replace it with something that truly is. And your father would have benefited from
Oh, there's no doubt in my mind.
That kind of
Absolutely.
Yeah.
My father would have benefited. My mother would have benefited. It was amazing to me. I would have benefited because I'd have known that the people that were there taking care of him solely at the time that they were there without concern for the other 50 people that were in the other adjoining, the other rooms on that floor.
Right.
Because it was a nightmare. It was an absolute nightmare until he got to hospice. And the last 9 days of his life were the most peaceful days out of the last 90 he spent, the last 9 days in hospice.
It's amazing. Your story, I've heard it, I can't even tell you, hundreds of times now after spending 15 years in this environment, the hospital and now hospice. I would go into a patient's room because I was requested to by the doctor, and I would walk in and I would be greeted at the door of the hospital room by the family, and I would say, hi, I'm Cameron, I'm from Hospice of Arizona, I'm here to see your, it was either father or mother or loved one. And time and time again, I would get the family member who would bring me back outside of the room and say, okay, come in, but just don't tell them you're from hospice. And I thought, but that's entirely different than what hospice is going to do. We're the savior here. We're the good news guys. We're not the bad news guys. We're here to assist for something that the hospital can't accomplish. This is good news.
Well, it was interesting along those very same lines when that doctor, who was probably the only doctor that gave us as straight a scoop as could be given, that gave us the thought of hospice at the time that he did. That doctor brought us outside the room and said, I don't like to say these types of things, even though your father's in and out and whatever. He may be sleeping, he may not be. He wasn't comatose, but he may be sleeping, may not be. He says, I always believe that somehow they still hear, but I think it's time we discuss hospice and the fact that we've done everything that we can medically for him. And I went, and I said to myself, I was kind of mixed, and I said, well, he's already asked me to help him, that I knew that. My mother didn't know that. He's already asked me to help assist him in his passing, and I said, I can't do that. And that was months ago. So why, you know. And it just, and it, the one and one was coming up something short of two in the whole process. So, and I don't want to beat this dead horse. I mean, it's already glue. But the fact is that I think, it's my personal feeling, and I don't know, maybe you agree, that one of your biggest battles is not with the families, but with the doctors.
Mm-hmm.
And getting the doctors to understand exactly what is and isn't available through hospice care and how they can help
right.
make the transition and, frankly, take some burden off of the people that are in the hospital, because I know these people were burdened and I was on them because they were burdened by me, you know.
You had a disservice from that particular physician who
yes.
should have said it in front of your father, because what he did for you is he pulled you out of the room, your family, and he said it to you only to know that you were going to have to go back in and say it to your father. It would have been better coming from a physician. to the entire family, including the patient, your father, so that it could have been received the way that it should have been.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've got some good news and bad news here. The bad news is that physicians, when they were going through their residency programs and their schooling, never had formal education, or if they did, it was very small, formal education in their studies about end-of-life treatment. So hospice was thought of as the opposite of curing. If I can't cure, I'm a failure. I have not done what I've been taught to do, so now I've got to turn it over to this area of medicine called hospice that I know nothing about. And therefore, I'm going to continue to go down the path of not knowing anything. That's the bad news. The good news is today, in 2011, residency programs and all of the training consists of much more of the end-of-life part of things.
Well, here's some more that I think is some bad news and a disservice that's being paid to the American public by the politicians. And that is when they start to badmouth the services that are being proposed and have now passed as saying that there are going to be death squads and people making determinations, and all of a sudden
right.
hospice starts can conceivably be grouped in. They're going to send you off to die. They're not going to treat you. They're going to cut off treatment. That just does not go anywhere to help exactly what it is that you're trying to do.
No, it sure doesn't.
It is counterproductive to the hospice activity and what the hospice activity is all about.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. The biggest misconception, and we've talked a lot about them, you know, here, but of all of the myths that currently exist out there, I think the one that's the most dangerous, as you pointed out, is the one that compares hospice to euthanasia or hospice to assisted suicide.
Yes.
And there couldn't be anything further from the truth. Hospice provides treatment. It provides care. Now, we call it palliative. We call it comfort. But there is plenty of treatment that goes on. There's not removal of treatment. So if somebody has a tube feeding and it's working, we're not going to remove it. We're going to make sure, as part of the hospice curriculum, that we're implementing it and monitoring it appropriately. And that's just one example. You said wound care. That's another example. If somebody needs hydration, that's another example. We're going to continue to provide treatment. The body itself, the human body, is breaking down. That's happening to all of us. And at some point, it's going to die. That's just the way that it goes. When that occurs, we want it to be the smoothest transition that it can be. And the way that that is done nowadays in the last 40 years is something called hospice. And this is the truth. If there someday is a cure to death, you know, we're all going to stand in line. But my thinking is that's never going to happen. I just don't think they're going to invent a cure for that. So, you know, if the smartest thing is to accept this, to embrace it, and to know that we are hospice, the industry of so many professionals across the United States and the world, is to make sure that we are providing the right kind of assistance at that point in somebody's life. And the longer that point can occur, and this is very important, a person dies suddenly. A person can die suddenly, but they do that so much less now. This isn't 1950 where a heart attack was going to be the end of your life. Now people are dying slow. They're not dying quickly anymore. So the fact that they're dying longer means that hospice is going to be a bigger and bigger and bigger part of our lives. The faster we embrace that and accept that, the better, because then it can be something that a person has for months or years and have those services coming into their house.
There's one thing I wanted to add and have your comment on as it regarded my father. When you mentioned the fact that whatever it was that he would have needed or wanted, i.e. wound care, in his case, he got wound care at hospice. He was cleansed. He was clean because he had no control. He laid in the bed. And he had no control over his own bodily functions. So they cleaned him and they washed him and they cared for him in that way. The hygiene aspects. They suctioned him because as he started to fill up with fluids, they would suction the fluids off so it would be easier for him to breathe. so he wouldn't drown in his own juices, so to speak. But he chose, not only in his living will, and also he chose by his own hand, when I tried to give him water using a straw as a dropper, he pushed my hand away and said, no more. So he was telling us that even at that stage, what he had written on that piece of paper and what he had notarized on that piece of paper is what he wanted. That was it.
Right.
He knew, and it was taking him time, and it took him 9 days to do whatever acceptance he had, to whatever was going through his mind, to finally take his final peaceful breaths. But the fact of the matter is, he knew what was going on, but what he did accept was the other things, although somewhat begrudgingly, because that was privacy issues as far as he was concerned. But he accepted those issues that were for his betterment, and the others, for instance, the water, the food, that's enough. That was his thing. It was enough. And hospice took care of it for him.
Mm.
He wasn't forced to do anything that he didn't want to do.
Right.
Certainly I didn't force him. My mother didn't force him, you know.
Right.
So, and his wishes were covered and taken care of by the hospice people, for which I will always be grateful.
That's a good story, and that's the good part of it.
It is. It is a good part of it. And I think that people need to understand that, and they need to understand that. And I now, in talking to you, understand that that service can commence much sooner than the last 9 days of his life.
Right.
As an example.
Right.
I mean, he could have had... conceivably, he could have had 90 days of that.
Yes.
You know, instead of 9 days. He could have had the whole 90 in hospice, I'm imagining.
It's not uncommon for a person to increase their quality of life being on hospice and actually live longer. It's not uncommon, I think, as you mentioned earlier in the show, for a person to have hospice and then sign off of hospice because they've improved that much.
Mm-hmm.
And although that doesn't happen very frequently, it does occur. And if we don't give people the opportunity to increase their quality of life, but rather push them into aggressive treatment that could really be futile, then we've done that disservice from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Futile and uncomfortable.
Right.
I mean, it's almost tortuous.
Yes.
How much of hospice care is covered by insurance?
Well, Medicare covers hospice 100%. It really is the greatest thing, in my opinion, that Medicare is able to do at this time for people that need a program this much and this extensive. Our program, the hospice program, is so underutilized in this country. And I think the best part and the part that I think we really need to push in Washington, D.C., is that hospice... It is reimbursed at 100%, as I said, but to be able to elect hospice at the appropriate times saves this country so much money when these people would otherwise be going into hospitals and utilizing services and resources in, let's say, an intensive care unit in an ICU that, and I use the word futile, but that would or could be futile when there aren't, we can't be saving these people's lives. We would attempt to, because that's what we do, but it would not happen in many cases. It's up to a physician to determine when and have that difficult conversation with a patient and or family to say, I know we can keep doing this. For instance, blood transfusions. We could keep providing this kind of thing, but I'm telling you, it's not going to make a difference. And I know that families and patients seek another doctor's advice.
Yeah, second, third opinions, yeah.
And when they do that, sometimes they get the same advice that hospice or palliative care is more appropriate. This is saving so much money. And that's important to understand that by way of choosing hospice, Medicare can actually be saving money and, most importantly, providing the right kind of care for that patient.
Let me give you a hypothetical. And it came to my mind when you talked about blood transfusions. If a person is in hospice and their doctor says that they need to have blood transfusions, they still can receive those blood transfusions in hospice, correct?
Well, I'll give you an example. It's kind of a long-winded one. It's not too long of a story, but it's a
go
story.
Go right ahead. That, no, just go right ahead.
It's a story that I tell many times when I'm relating the instances of blood transfusions and the need for hospice. It's a story about a patient.
Excuse me.
At Boswell Hospital, and this is about 3 years ago, and I walked in because I was consulted by the oncologist, the cancer doctor, and this patient that I was going to go see had lung cancer and also a stomach ulcer that was so bad he was requiring a blood transfusion because he was bleeding from that ulcer. He was requiring a transfusion one unit a day, every day.
Wow.
With lung cancer, end stage. And I walked in thinking that this family and this patient was ready for hospice. And when I walked in, the daughter of the patient said, "So you're going to give blood transfusions to us at home and follow up at home as home health?" And I said, "No, I'm sorry if you were misled, but that is not what we can do. Hospice is going to provide comfort care because hospice cannot provide blood transfusions. That's not an area, at least not permanently. Now, every hospice is going to be a little bit different in what they can accomplish. If there was a need for a couple of them, that's probably something hospice could cover. But ongoing aggressive treatment, those measures cannot be under Medicare covered by hospice because hospice is for palliative care, comfort, and aggressive treatment is done by a hospital. So Medicare can't cover those at the same time. In this case, as in many cases, when blood transfusions are doing nothing but artificially prolonging somebody's life, they're really that treatment is completely ineffective. And although it's the hardest thing that a patient and family could hear, the honest truth would be to say, there isn't anything else that can be done. The hospice will be there while your father passes away in at home or in an inpatient unit, whatever you choose, but we can't keep going in this. There isn't anything else that can be done. Plus, in this case, lung cancer was killing him anyway. So there were a lot of issues there, and you know, I only relate that because of the story of the blood transfusion, but we cannot permanently have that ongoing.
What types of treatment do not fall under the hospice care?
Well, a lot of times a person that does have cancer will be undergoing chemotherapy. So if that is an aggressive form of treatment, and it is, then we have to wait until that patient either gets better from that or doesn't. And if they don't, and if chemotherapy has been attempted but has been unsuccessful, that is when it is appropriate for us to step in and manage that patient's care at home for whatever they need. That's one example for cancer. A lot of people are on dialysis for end-stage renal failure. We can't do anything while somebody's on dialysis if their diagnosis is end-stage renal failure. Now, a lot of times, if somebody has a different diagnosis that is not associated with end-stage renal failure and they're on dialysis, we can do something because their diagnosis for hospice would be something else. But those aggressive measures that people are undergoing to preserve their life, we have to let the patient manage that or the family manage that course of treatment. And when they're ready, when their body has said it's enough, then we step in. Now,
okay.
those are very significant aggressive
things.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But there are times when the person, the patient, the family of the patient has to make the decision.
There are times.
I mean, they're always right. they have to make that decision with or without hospice. They still have to make that decision.
Yes, they've got to have the conversation.
Yes.
With their loved ones, with their doctors.
Exactly.
What is their quality of life? Because their quality of life, the patient, might be a lot different than what the expectation is of the doctor
mm-hmm.
or the expectation of the family, and that's where these conversations have to occur.
Now, are those conversations that a hospice care manager would have with that person?
It is certainly one we would start.
Okay.
We would want that to occur.
Okay. I'm trying to think of how it was that my father came to. I don't know how he came to be in hospice, but I'm trying to think of how it was handled. I'm frankly don't remember. The doctor said thus and such. We said, yes, we agree. And there was a social worker involved, mm-hmm. I believe, or somebody that worked for, somebody maybe that worked for Arizona, Hospice of Arizona.
That came in to see you.
Yes, I'm trying to remember her name. She was an angel. Gosh, she was an angel. Any rate, she was the one that answered all of our, she was a social worker type,
mm-hmm.
answered all the questions with regard to what was going to happen,
right.
and how it was going to be taken care of, and we said, okay, let's do it. You know?
Right. It's exceptionally important to know that by choosing hospice, if somebody elects hospice, it's not a death sentence. It is an attempt to provide comfort and a higher quality of life. But we've had a lot of people that have accepted hospice and then changed their mind a day later. And it's completely okay to sign off of hospice. And it's also okay to sign back on. So we want to always make sure that just by contacting a hospice agency and asking for information does not mean you've signed up. You know, that is two separate things. And I would encourage anybody listening to, if this is a kind of a scenario where you're questioning would hospice be an appropriate service for a person considering their end-stage illness, just call a hospice company and say, I want more information. This is what's going on to my father or my mother or my grandmother or my grandfather, whoever it is. This is what's occurring in their life. At what point would hospice be appropriate, do you think? And that hospice company should be able to facilitate a visit or at least an answer over a phone.
Evaluation of some
sort.
Sure, yeah.
Sure. And that doesn't mean that you've elected to go the route of hospice. It just means you want more information about how they could help. The best example I can think of for a diagnosis is COPD, which is chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or some kind of chronic respiratory illness, because those types of illnesses linger, and they're slow a lot of times in their decline. And what you see with those diseases is frequent ER visits, frequent hospitalization. Those are especially important to contact hospice to see what kind of intervention can be done so that hospitalization doesn't have to keep occurring. And that's exceptional. I mean, that really is important for a person to at least find out about.
So it's conceivable, is it conceivable, I should ask, that a person could have those reoccurring situations for those types of diseases, but it could be handled by the hospice care?
Correct, yes. And many times more appropriate, because in those moments of exacerbation and high anxiety due to a respiratory illness, it's much quicker to call a hospice company if you're on hospice and transfer to an inpatient unit or a setting where anxiety and shortness of breath can be managed than it would be to transfer to an emergency room. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you've ever been to an emergency room, it's not fun.
No.
There's just nothing fun about it. And a lot of times the waiting room is full and the, you know.
Well, panic ensues by the fact that you're going there by the use of its name, emergency,
right.
And the fact that you see people in distress when you get there.
Right.
I mean, it's negative, negative, negative.
Right, right.
You know, and if you get out of there, that's the positive, it's getting out.
Right.
The hospice patient, what I found in my experience was that the fact that hospice, he was actually in your facility, but nonetheless, we were there, and we could spend whatever time we wanted to spend with him and not worry about, although you always worry about the care that he's getting, but be assured and felt comfortable that he was going to be getting the best palliative care and the best care he could have, and we could spend our time with him.
Right.
That was, I think, more than anything, what made our experience of his passing tolerable. Because if we'd have been fighting with the medical professionals to the bitter end, and then they come in and they say, he's dead, pull the sheet over him and send him out of here, we were there when he took his, we were physically at his bedside when he took his last breath. I walked out to the nurse's station and I said, I think he's gone. And they came and checked, yes, he is. we can make the rest of the arrangements for you. And they took care of everything. I mean, they called the mortuary. The mortuary came and picked them up. They had everything prepaid, which was wonderful for me personally. But nonetheless, they took care of it. We walked away in peace, went home, sat at the table, and had a cup of coffee. And we would never have been able to do that if it had been the trauma of the death in a hospital. I just don't see how it could have happened.
You know, I'm glad that you had the experience to be able to share this with listeners, because when I say it, it kind of sounds like I might know what I'm talking about, but from an empathetic standpoint, this occurred to you. This,
right.
this happened in your life. And I've been on both sides of the curtain. I mean, I really have been, and I've seen what death is in a hospital. It's institutional, it's impersonal, and they even use the word expire in a hospital. The patient has expired, as if, you know, we're a carton of milk. And there isn't anything worse than that for a family.
It's like putting a stamp on his forehead, expired.
I know. There's nothing worse for a family than to see this and hear this and feel this occur inside an institutional-type setting. I mean, if somebody dies inside a hospital, there isn't anybody to help there. All they do is have the body taken down to the morgue, and, well, you know, good luck getting that, you know, to the mortuary, that body on its way, and that responsibility falls on you, the family member. Whereas in hospice, as you just illustrated, you get to be present in a comfortable setting, whether it's home or in one of our own inpatient units. You get to experience that with professionals there that deal with death and dying on a regular basis. And then they manage the mortuary and other arrangements as you need. Plus, for 1 year,
yes,
1 year after the date of passing,
yes,
you get to have bereavement support as a family member if you need it.
That was also something, I'm glad you brought that up, because frankly, I had forgotten that that had happened. During the process of him being there for those 9 days, there was always somebody there asking if we were okay.
Right.
How were we dealing with it? Is there anything they could do, whether it be just supportive, talking about him, talking about our relationship with him, if there was clergy that we would like to have had present, and then after the fact, you're right. I remember every. Periodically, and initially it was like every 30 days, and then it went to be 3 months, and then it went to be 6 months. But eventually, this social worker would call and say, "Hi, how are you? How's everything going? Do you have any problems? Do you have any issues? Are you okay?" You know, she was wonderful, and we were fine, and we were fine for a couple of reasons. We were fine because of we knew how he went out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We had anger with people previous to hospice, but hospice managed to round off some of those sharp edges,
right.
You know,
sure.
If that makes any sense. But it was due to hospice. And I'll tell anybody that, I mean, I go to these networking groups all the time, and there's a guy there in one of our networking groups that he's a mortician, and you know, we all make the jokes, you know, dying to get in, and the guy that plays the music, little stingers, plays digging up bones whenever he gives his 15-second thing. But the reality of the situation is that I can relate to him now better when he starts talking about prearrangements and all those kinds of things, simply because of what we went through.
Mm-hmm.
And the willingness and the openness to talk about it is, on my part, in doing a great deal to my experience with hospice. Because otherwise, I still may be PO'd to this day.
Right.
You know?
No, it's very true. And it's unfortunate that that's the experience that families sometimes have coming out of a hospital. Because believe me, hospitals do a wonderful job. Majority of the time, I think experiences in hospitals are very difficult for families and patients, but they have a remarkable ability to accomplish what modern medicine is all about, I mean, it really is amazing. But as I've gone and I've said, there's no cure for death, and there's no cure for aging. We're all doing it. It's going to happen, so we might as well face up to that. And I think what my message is on a regular basis out in the community when I'm giving presentations is death is not a myth. It's not something that's fabricated. It's going to happen. So let's talk about it. I was out in the East Valley giving a presentation the other day, and I asked the question, how many people here have living wills and have created a medical power of attorney and advanced directives at this time? And I'd say the average age in that room was probably 45, maybe 50. And I expected half the room to raise their hand. And out of 120 people, six raised their hand. Six people. I mean, I was shocked, and it took me aback. I really didn't know what to say for a second. I said, this is the time to make those arrangements. You don't wait until you're 85 and go, well, I should create a living will. You just don't do that. I have mine. At 42 years old, my wife and I have our arrangements made. Now, we can change them if it's ever a necessity. But for now, if something were to happen, I was in a car accident, had a traumatic brain injury, I wasn't able to make decisions for myself, these things are set and ready for my wife to be able to, find and to relay to physicians and to medical personnel.
Maybe you're not the person to ask this question of, but if let's say that you have had a trauma and you are unable to make your own decisions and choices, and you have written what you've written for whatever your care is to be, or when they're directed to let you go on your own, can your wife change that?
Can she change it?
Yes.
She cannot. As medical power of attorney, all she can accomplish is whatever I've outlined in my living will. She is the directive and can do what she wants. And actually, in Arizona, the medical power of attorney supersedes the living will. So regardless of what I've actually written in the living will, she can do what she wants in way of deciding what kind of medical intervention I should have. So I don't know if that was the question, but
more or less,
she can't change it like the verbiage inside the medical power of attorney, but she can make decisions according to what she wants. But that's why it's so important to pick a person who is going to follow your wishes as medical director. I mean, medical power of attorney.
So if your decision is to withhold nutrition, withhold whatever.
Artificial food.
Artificial food, whatever. And can she say, all right, let's institute this now? Or will it automatically be instituted right from the get-go?
No, she would be able to. The physician, because she's medical power of attorney, they would come to her, and the physicians and the team of people would say, here's what we see in way of his recovery possibility, his potential. It's not good or it's good, whatever it is, and she could make an educated decision based on what my wishes are and what they are telling her. So if they're saying, you know, let's do this for 10 days and see what happens and maybe there's recovery possibility, then, you know, that's realistic. I think that that's not like permanent discomfort that I would be in.
Right.
So I think she would go ahead and try that for whatever time they're specifying. And if at the end of that period of time there's no recovery or it doesn't look good, then she could go ahead and kind of honor my wishes at that point or whatever she wants to do. But every case is going to be different, of course.
Right.
And depending on my age and my previous quality of life, I'm sure she would take those things into consideration.
Sure. I was wondering how that absolutely worked. I mean, I guess I know for a fact that when my wife's mother passed, there was a situation where they knew that she was going to be going relatively soon, but they gave her a chance. They gave her, I guess, one or two attempts at dialysis to see if it would alleviate some issues and the heart would, you know, whatever. But and my wife said, well, if the second one doesn't work, well, then then it'll be time.
Mm-hmm.
So that is still option is still available with the living will and the medical power of attorney.
Right.
It's good to know.
Yeah, and wish more people would take it upon themselves to get that done. It's a very simple process. This is not like going to an attorney and paying $500 to get it done. You can get it off the internet. You can fill it out, have a notary present, or even a witness if a notary isn't necessary, which in Arizona it's not. It's when people are in the hospital, we just need a witness not related to them to make that a legal document and file it away. You know, make sure that somebody knows where it is. Give one a copy of that to a physician, primary care.
Exactly. Well, Cameron, I don't know. Have we touched on all the bases, do you think, or is there still things that you think we need to know?
I think we've hit just about everything. I mean, there's always more. I think one of the important things to know, I might have said this at the beginning, but my position as Director of Education and Advocacy for American Hospice and here at Hospice of Arizona is really to create programs that present hospice in a palatable light so that people aren't afraid of it, that they don't run from it whenever Cameron walks into the room or whenever there is a hospice program on the docket, that they look at that and they say, you know, I've heard that hospice is different today. Maybe we should listen to this. Maybe we should be receptive to it. I just want people to understand that it is essential. It's not something that is, hey, it's, you know, I choose this. It's going to be essential for just about everybody at some point in their lives, just about everybody. And the boomers that are listening, their parents.
78 million. Potential.
Right.
I mean, that's a big, big old number there.
And, yes.
And every one of us are going to die, and every one of us are closer to dying now than we've ever been.
Right. And for the boomers who have their parents who are still alive,
exactly.
Still living.
Exactly.
If they're going through a decline, if they're experiencing a disease or a disease process that is not being managed effectively, this is the time to call hospice and say, what can be accomplished?
Mm-hmm.
Having the difficult conversation, because believe me, one of the biggest things is having that conversation with mom or dad. There are so many people out there that say, I can't bring that up.
Mm-hmm.
I can't talk about that. Well, you don't have to necessarily, because there can be the doctor or the doctor's suggestion of a hospice that can talk about it. So all you need to do as a boomer is to be the liaison, that mediator.
Facilitator.
The facilitator, yep. To bring in somebody that is an expert to have the conversation, and that's it. And then, you know, kind of make sure that people understand that hospice is not what it used to be. It's so much bigger and better, and that's what my programs are all about.
What can somebody do that I'll just use myself as an example. I've been making an example of myself all morning. What can somebody do that if I wanted to be involved in hospice work, I don't have any qualifications to deal with bereavement. I don't have any. I would feel a little bit odd trying to put myself into a situation when somebody is having their own private moments. You know, as to comfort and so on and so forth. I don't know that I could do a good job there. But what else could somebody do short of that to assist in hospice?
One of the greatest parts about many hospice companies is they have a volunteer branch or a department for volunteers, and those tend to be the larger hospices. Hospice of Arizona has approximately 250 volunteers, and many of them do not participate at the bedside of a patient because they don't want to, like you just said. They don't feel they're proficient. They don't feel comfortable to do it, and that's okay. That's completely okay. There are a lot of other things to get involved with that are away from dealing with patients and families directly but still making an impact on them. We have some pet volunteers. We've got music volunteers, musical therapy type stuff. There are a lot of groups that they can lead or be a part of for bereavement support. There are a lot of other administrative type tasks that can be done. A lot of people man the front desk at our inpatient units. It really is just wanting to get involved with what the philosophy of hospice is. And if you believe in that, most people do. I'm finding that especially once they've had an experience with it, they believe in it to the core of them. And they want to be involved, and being a volunteer is the first way.
And there are things to do, stuffing envelopes.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, the secretarial or administrative assistant type things, anything that you want to do that is a need, and all you have to do is really inquire.
Mm-hmm.
You know, calling, I know many people that I've talked with after I've spoken to some of the assisted living and independent living facilities, they will ask just what you asked. How do I get involved? And I'll say, call Hospice of Arizona. Call and ask, and you pick up the phone, dial the number, ask the person there. They'll direct you to the volunteer department, and if you want to do it, you can.
Okay. How do people get hold of you or hospice? What is the contact information?
Well, the direct contact information for Hospice of Arizona is 602-678-1313. That is the main number. So just calling that 24 hours a day, you'll be able to contact somebody. During business hours, you'd obviously find that person and be willing to, they'd be able to transfer you to whatever department you are looking for. If anybody wants to email me, they can email at cameron.svensson@americanhospice.com. I realize that's a lot, but that's cameron.svensson, svensen.
Is that a good Swedish name?
That is Norwegian.
A Norwegian name.
Yes. Which I don't know any Norwegian at all. The language remains foreign. but I do know how to say Svensson most of the
time.
Well,
you say Svensson very well. well, I tell you, Cameron, it's been a real pleasure having you here. And I know it's, to some people, it's a subject that they don't want to talk about, they don't want to hear about, they just as soon ignore it until it happens. I found that it is not the right thing to do, to ignore it until it happens, because I think we availed ourselves of hospice care for my father too late in the game. We certainly could have done it 3 or 4 weeks earlier, if nothing else. So I think people need to keep that in mind, and don't be afraid of it, because the end is going to come whether you like it or not.
Right.
And if you're going out, you may as well go out comfortably.
Could have said it better myself.
You know, that's just the way it is. Well, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate
you
having me here. As always, we try to give our listeners something to think about, and I think we've accomplished that today. You've been listening to the Boomer the Babe Show on Blog Talk Radio, where we bring good conversation to the world. Today, we brought you information and conversation with Mr. Cameron Svensson of Hospice of Arizona, American Hospice. And you can listen to the Boomer the Babe Show every Monday through Friday at 10 o'clock right here on Blog Talk Radio. Remember, we do much more than just host this radio show on Blog Talk. Check us out at boomerandthebabe.com. That's boomerandthebabe.com. See everything that makes up the Boomer the Babe Incorporated. Be sure to make the second half of your life the best half of your life, and that includes hospice care when you need it. So we'll see you again next week. Have a great weekend, everybody. Talking to you on Monday, and we're going to be talking about energy alternatives and things that you can do with different energy companies and making different energy choices. Thanks again. Have a great weekend. You've been listening to the Boomer the Babe Show, where we bring interesting conversation to the world. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, where we tweet as Boomer and Babe, and on Facebook as Pete Peters 47. As always, you can friend us on Blog Talk Radio or sign up for our newsletter at boomerandthebabe.com. Email us at host@boomerthebabe.com with any of your comments. Remember, at 50, you're just getting started.